we're going to call the July 10th. Sorry, don't panic. July 10th meeting of the Rules Committee. I said September meeting of the Rules Committee.
That is sick.
Yeah, it's really sick. We're going to have hearings and work session on a couple of bills, plus a measure drafting introduction request to consider. Can we do the measure drafting? And we don't have a quorum, so we won't. He's right in the back of the room, actually.
Now we have a quorum.
I'm going to open up a public hearing on measure introductions and bill requests.
Madam Chair, you have a memo that describes it. We made copies available for the public also.
Madam Chair, I move that we accept the measure drafting request from Representative Brown for the Oregon State Grange exempting, is this photo or photon light?
Photon
light assemblers from workers' compensation coverage, which is the reincarnation of House Bill 3622.
Senator Clarno has moved that we approve a request from Representative Brown and the Oregon State Grange, which is a reincarnation of House Bill 3622. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection, Senator Beyer? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. That will open a public hearing on House Bill 2390. Representative Haas, come on up. And Jan, do you want to give us some information about the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2390 current law allows non-compete clauses in agreements between employers and employees. An employee can't work for a competitor for a period of time following termination of their employment. House Bill 2390 proposes to prohibit these clauses from running longer than 1 year in the broadcasting industry. As amended, the bill also avoids non-competition agreements if the employee is laid off or if the employee leaves employment because the employer fails to make a good faith offer to renew the contract on reasonable terms. There's also three amendments that are attached to the bill summary, which goes into a little more detail. And it passed the House 45-12.
Great. Thanks. Representative Haas, welcome to your Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Mark Haas, State Representative, House District 27. Originally, this bill was designed to prohibit non-compete provisions in the broadcast industry because of their increasing nature on the lower paid people in television and radio stations in Oregon. They were seen as unfair to a lot of those employees. Some of whom were fired or laid off, and while they tried to find other work in their hometown, they were told by their previous employer that they couldn't because of this non-compete provision. We had in the House several hours of testimony, including many of those people who came down from Portland or from Bend or Eugene, who told tales of the unfairness inherent in this practice, which is illegal in states like California. Ultimately, we ended up with a compromise measure that ended up with the bill in front of you that says non-competes cannot be allowed if someone is laid off, if their contract is not renewed, or if they're fired. And while I wasn't thrilled with that bill, and I think the broadcasters were not thrilled either, it was a compromise, and that's what came out of the House, and I urge your support for that compromise.
Thank you. Representative Haas, I have a number of members of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters signed up against this proposal. Was there, when you say this is a compromise, could you talk about how the compromise was reached and who was at the table at that time?
Well, my understanding is the Association of Oregon Broadcasters, and you can call them up and they can tell you this, voted to support the draft amendment that was written by this Judiciary Chairman in the House, Representative Williams. And so they supported that, and we both testified in favor of that bill when it passed the House. And we made the joke that it was like kissing your sister, and I'm not going to kiss you, David, wherever you are. And so that's where that came from.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Haas? Thanks for joining us. You're welcome to stay if you don't have anything else to do. I'd like Dave Fiscom, Dave Litloff, and Ron Carter to come on up, please. Hi, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Dave Fiscom. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters to raise questions about the need for House Bill 2390. As you may or may not know, the OAB consists of about 145 radio stations around the state, as well as 25 television stations. Joining me, prepared to make comments to you today, are several members of our association. To my immediate left, Ron Carter from Fisher Broadcasting in Portland. To his left, David Lipoff, Vice President, General Manager of KOIN-TV, the CBS affiliate in Portland. And as well, behind them are Mike Cheney, General Manager of Combined Communications, which operates four radio stations in the Bend area. As well, David McDonald, Senior Vice President of Infinity Radio in Portland, and in the audience today, prepared to help answer questions. Should you have questions, are Bill Johnstone, the President and CEO of the Association, and Don Monahan, Legal Counsel for the Association. I'll make a few brief comments to introduce this, and then, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I'd prefer to allow my colleagues to speak to you since they have traveled a ways in some cases to do so. I'll just begin by summarizing how we arrived here today. The House bill is Representative Haas, and I pledge not to kiss him either today. Arrives before you from the House Judiciary Committee, where we contended before that committee that we thought there was no compelling public policy case for legislative intervention in what should be, we believe, private contractual matters. As originally drafted, the bill would have prohibited contracts that included non-compete clauses in the broadcast industry, and in fact, in the broadcast industry only, and again, in fact, only for on-air employees in that industry. We raised questions in the House and do so again here today about the idea of targeting one industry for this intervention. To illustrate that point, the six amendments before you are meant by me, by the OAB, to indicate that if you choose to go in this direction, you might want to consider applying the prescriptions of House Bill 2390 to all industrial sectors in Oregon as opposed just to the broadcast industry. But my purpose is not to appear before you today to advocate that amendment necessarily. It's mostly to talk to you about the bill on its face. As you'll hear from the panelists in a moment, non-compete clauses are important in the broadcast industry to protect the often very substantial investments that broadcast managers make to promote on-air talent and radio and TV on radio and TV stations around the state. If the ability to include such clauses is removed or compromised or abridged, employees could move next door in some cases, especially in metro areas at a moment's notice, compromising that investment. The fact is that broadcast managers will be far less willing to make those investments if that risk exists in their on-air talent. If there have been isolated problems with such non-compete clauses in contracts, we believe and are fully prepared to review those problems individually. In my past, when I used to work in congressional offices, we'd call that casework. And I say that very genuinely to you, that if there is an issue that needs to be addressed, we will do that on a case-by-case basis, for we believe there is no cause to move from an isolated or from anecdotes to statutes. Representative Haas has characterized the situation in the House accurately because we worked there with the chair, Representative Max Williams, to produce a compromise, which is the A engrossed version of House Bill 2390. And your staff has well described for you what that does in terms of limiting the length of non-competes to a year, as well as indicating they cannot be employed in the case of layoff, which is contained in Section 9, Sub D of the A engrossed bill. If you choose to move ahead with HB 2390, we would advocate that you stick with the compromise negotiated in the House. by a close 9-7 vote. The OAB board approved that compromise after long discussion. I would say did so, if this is the word, grudgingly or with some misgivings, instructing me to raise basic questions about this bill if the bill was heard as it is today in the Senate. And I would tell you straightforwardly that in preparation for this hearing a few months ago, I did talk to Representative Williams about the fact that I would intend to do that. And without necessarily suggesting he gave me permission to do so, in a conversation with him, he recognized that, as I do, this is a two-chamber process, and he thought it was entirely appropriate for us to raise these issues here without either jeopardizing or compromising the intent of the compromise he helped to negotiate there. That much of the due diligence done by me before we appear before you today. So, with that, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to answer questions along with my colleagues, but with your indulgence, Madam Chairs, excuse me, I would suggest that we continue on and allow my colleagues to make some comments to you. Ron?
Madam Chairs, committee members, and other interested parties, my name is Ron Carter. I am here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2390. For the past 6 years, I have been the general manager, vice president, general manager of radio stations KWJJ FM and KOTK AM in Portland. Prior to that, I served as general manager of four radio stations in Kansas City for 8 years. So I come before you today with a total of 14 years experience running radio stations. My career spans 30 years in this business. House Bill 2390 is a very narrowly written bill which would limit non-competition clauses in employment agreements between on-air talent and their employers, the radio and TV stations of Oregon. Historically, non-competition agreements have been used in our industry to protect stations from competitive raids. They are very common and very standard in our industry, and in fact in many other industries, and have been so for many years. They are executed at the time of the employee's hiring as part of a contract between the employee and the employer, a contract that provides security to the employee. Let me share with you an example specific to our station. In late 1999, KWJJ, our country station, needed a new morning show. We hired Mike Chase, a former personality at another station who had been out of work for over a year. We paired him with Amy Faust, who had never been on radio or television. Thus was created the Mike and Amy Show. Because the morning show is such an important part of a radio station's success, we have invested very heavily to advertise the Mike and Amy Show. You may have seen some of the television commercials that have run over the past 3 years, or the outdoor campaign, or the table tent cards that were in McDonald's last September, or a series of direct mail pieces, on and on. KWJJ invested $1,750,000 during the three-year period, 2000 to 2002, to promote the Mike and Amy Show. We recently completed a February television advertising and cash giveaway program in support of the Mike and Amy Show, an investment of over $230,000. Additionally, a good deal of the radio station's airtime is used to promote the Mike and Amy Show. With all this support, the show has grown from a pure startup to a very good morning show. It has exceptional value in the marketplace and would easily fit on other radio stations. It has the value and stature it enjoys because KWJJ took the risk to put it on the air, because KWJJ has invested heavily to advertise it. Both Mike and Amy have non-competition agreements to protect the station's investment. Without the non-competes, nothing would preclude a competitor from stealing the product and all of KWJJ's product development costs. What about our other performers? Well, they have no competes as well. Every day, they're on the air 5 hours a day on a 50,000-watt radio station, promoting themselves and their show, building their audience, becoming a part of the fabric of the radio station. attending remote broadcasts, concerts, station events as members of the KWJJ team. They become part of the KWJJ family, and to the extent they are successful without non-competes, would be subject to competitive raids. Any show that the station took a chance on, a show that the station gave 5 hours every day to, a show that the station promoted and coached and developed, gone, possibly stolen by a competitor. What would happen without non-competition agreements? Bottom line, we think Oregonians would pay the price. Here's how. If the stations faced the prospect of losing talent so easily, there would be no reason to invest in development of that talent. There would be no reason to risk expense to recruit and hire highly paid employees. The result would be the hiring of talent that stations could afford to lose, certainly leading to poorer entertainment for Oregonians, poorer news, less well-known, less trusted television and radio performers. Seems to me that in these days when this state needs business to invest and when this state needs income tax revenue, elimination of non-competition agreements would eliminate promotional budgets and eliminate highly paid jobs. Like patents protect R&D costs of pharmaceuticals, non-competes protect R&D costs of talent in the broadcast industry. House Bill 2390 is not good for the broadcast business. It's not good for the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. I hope you understand the fundamental problems and outcomes that would be created if House Bill 2390 becomes law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Lipoff. I'm the Vice President and General Manager of Coin 6 Television, the CBS television affiliate in Portland, Oregon. And I, too, am here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2390 and to ask you to oppose it as well. By way of background, I'm a native Oregonian with a 34-year career in television broadcasting. I began my career as a news intern, then a reporter and an anchor before making the decision to move into news management, first as a newscast producer, then an executive news producer, an assistant news director, and a news director. My 22 years on the news side of the business included positions in Eugene, in Portland, Detroit, San Francisco, Atlanta. And for the past 12 years, I've been vice president and general manager of major television affiliates in Dayton, Ohio, in Orlando, Florida, and now again in Portland, Oregon. Throughout my career, I've held positions in station management and in news that required me to sign an employment agreement, a contract, and each of these agreements contains specific non-compete clauses. I understood and understand they exist because the companies that asked me to work for them had invested and would continue to invest substantial amounts of money and make other efforts to secure and retain audiences for the station and for the program's I, as an on-air performer, would appear on. I understood that my standing as an on-air personality would be enhanced because of my appearances on the air for the benefit of the audiences that the station had invested in building. And I understood that my standing as an on-air personality would have a unique and extraordinary character, which would be of substantial and unique value to the station in retaining those audiences. In television, it's not just the primary anchor talent that's identified with the station, part of the station's brand. It's anyone who's on the air, whose face and name and work product is promoted or marketed as a part of that station's news organization. So at Coin 6 Television, it's Coin 6 News' reporter Eric Taylor, Coin 6 News reporter Lori Schilling, Northwest News Channel 8's John Becker, Channel 2 News reporter Anna Song, or Fox 12 News at 10's Dave Wilson. These people are part of the brand, part of the investment that stations have made and continue to make to set themselves apart from the competition. The vast majority of on-air people in our industry work with employment agreements that contain non-compete language. These people are professionals, they're knowledgeable, they are well compensated and cared for by the stations that employ them, and they are aware of the limited temporary restrictions that these agreements represent for them. They also understand that irreparable harm can occur if an on-air performer, someone who's part of the station's brand, uses that standing as an on-air personality against the interests of their station following the expiration or termination of that employment agreement. They understand that the station is entitled to this reasonable protection against loss or impairment of that investment and those promotional efforts if an on-air performer was to provide services to a competing station without first remaining off the air in that marketplace for a reasonable period of time. What we ask is that for that reasonable period of time, an on-air performer refrain from participating in any performance, broadcast, promotion, or appearance for the benefit of any other station located in the market. We don't hide this condition from people when we talk with them about employment, just as we don't camouflage or withhold information about compensation, fringe benefits, the length of the employment offer, services they're being asked to perform, or the fact that the station, not the individual, owns the material that appears in programs and broadcasts. These employment agreements also confirm that an employee has a right to enter into the agreement. Typically, the language states that the individual understands that they have the right to grant the station rights granted to it in the agreement, and that the individual is at full liberty and is willing and able to perform all of the services required by the agreement. To underscore all of this, these employment agreements usually ask the employee to acknowledge that they are entering into the contract voluntarily and knowingly, and that they have been given the opportunity to discuss this agreement with legal counsel. I've used these employment agreements with non-compete language in every market, in every state in which I've worked. They are basic to our business, not just the broadcast business, though, and the non-compete concept is basic to business, not just the broadcast business, and certainly not just with on-air employees in the broadcast business. We invest heavily in the recruitment, training, and marketing of our on-air employees, helping them to achieve celebrity status. We share proprietary information, plans, and research with them. If House Bill 2390 is enacted, it would ultimately lead to less collaborative work and less training for employees. Neither of these is a good business practice. It is grossly unfair to single out and target the broadcast industry, an industry that provides a free service to the citizens of this state. I respectfully argue that it is inappropriate for the Oregon legislature to intrude in the middle of what is and should continue to be a contractual decision between broadcasters and their employees. The law has long recognized that there is a legitimate and protectable interest for employers, including broadcasters, to use non-competes as long as they are reasonable in terms of duration, the geographic area where competition is excluded, and the scope of the activity that's prohibited. New legislation is not needed. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee on this matter.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Burdick.
And this can be for anybody on the panel, I guess. In the bill, it doesn't allow any, it allows a non-compete for a year, and I understand that you oppose the bill. But what is the situation now if someone is, say, an anchor, they have a non-compete, and their audience declines? They haven't done any insubordination or malfeasance, but you decide not to, the management decides not to renew their contract. What's the status of the non-compete now?
First of all, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in terms of our situation at the station, contracts are negotiated individually with individuals. So let me give you, try and respond to your question and give you an example. If we had a situation where we felt we had a performer who wasn't performing up to the level of our expectations, and they had an employment agreement with us, there are aspects of that employment agreement that would allow us at certain times, and certainly at the end of that full term of the agreement, to make a decision that would no longer carry forward with the employee in that role at the television station. If they had a non-compete with us, typically that non-compete, even under a situation like that, would be for a period of 1 year. However, let me add that at the time that the individual entered into that agreement, at his or her free will, everybody had the same understanding that at a point at the end of the agreement, whether it's for the employee's decision, which happens probably with more frequency, at least in our business, or at the station's discretion at the end of the contract, that there would be a period of time, for us it's defined as 1 year in our employment agreements, where there would be a period of non-competition. And we don't force people enter into work relationships with us. Everybody does this voluntarily, so.
Yeah, Madam Chair, don't you think it's a little unfair to, you know, you hire somebody and they, you know, everybody assumes it's going to work. I mean, Mike and Amy may not have worked. That may not have. Is it Mike and Amy?
Yeah.
Right, I understand that. But so if it doesn't work, then you're basically telling that person that they either have to go on unemployment or go into another field or move to another city when they have not done anything. They've tried their hardest and they haven't done anything, you know, malfeasance or anything like that, and do you consider that a little unfair?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, but occasionally that will happen, in which case that individual is guaranteed by the nature of that contract employment, regardless for the period of the employment agreement. And the stations are obligated to honor those employment contracts, and the employees understand it's common knowledge and common understanding in this business. The employees understand the nature of the agreements that they sign. Agreements go two ways. They go to benefit the employee in a matter of security, and they go to the benefit of the stations in a matter of security as well.
Well, but, you know, and I'm not talking about the duration of the contract, and a contract's a contract, and you are obligated. But if you decide not to renew the contract, the thought being that they are not of value to you anymore, how could it be justified to keep them from working somewhere else?
Madam Chairs and member of the committee, there is not a standard disconnect procedure in all of these cases. In some cases, non-competes are waived, but broadcasters still want the opportunity to have those non-competes and to enforce them in cases of competitive race. In some cases, they are waived. Each individual is treated on an individual basis. In some cases, they're offered employment of another nature at the same radio station. This is not as imposing as it might sound. These are human relations that the stations and the operators work very carefully on.
Madam Chair, we'd be pleased to recede for a moment. There are two more people who'd like to testify, but I know the senator is here who's the sponsor of the bill, and so we'd be happy to step aside if that's your will.
That's fine. Before you leave, I just wanted to ask one question about in terms of the process and the compromise, and you answered my question about the process. Talk to me about the substance, and I'm not getting the distinction here. I hear what your folks are saying about opposing the statutory change, but so why is the compromise not a good one? I guess is what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I wouldn't say the compromise is not a good one. We felt it was our obligation as an industry to present to you the entire issue from the ground up, as opposed to from the steps, the platform built in the House. In good faith and in good conscience, we negotiated there. In good faith and in good conscience, if it turns out to be your wish, we'll negotiate here. At the same time, I think the issues, as described by my colleagues from the industry, are serious enough and big enough, and the implications are big enough that we thought it was important to raise for you the entire issue. And we received, again, we chose to do that on our own, so I don't mean to suggest that we received permission from anybody to do this, but we decided this was the best posture for us to be in today. But we negotiated there, and if it turns out to be the case, we'll negotiate here. That compromise we stood behind over there, it was a decent one, it was negotiated, there was a limit on the length as well as the definition of the term layoff. If you read Section 9, Sub B, I guess the bottom line, Madam Chair, is that was then, now is now.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, I have real concerns with that issue. Is that how this works now with the lobby, that we have to negotiate by chamber?
Well, Madam Chair, certainly not. We are aware of the process, and Senator Corcoran, as you know, I am, having been here for a long number of years. I've characterized things accurately to you. We thought it was entirely appropriate for our industry to raise the entire issue in this bill as opposed only to raise the platform we built in the House. We did that in good conscience and in good faith, as I said, and we'll do the same here. And I've tried to be candid with you by indicating what, in fact, and take initiative to do so, what, in fact, we were doing in the issues we were raising. We think it's important enough for this body, as well as the other body, to deal with the entire issue, not just the piece of that that happened to come to you in HB 2390-A. I understand your question. I appreciate it. I hope you'll find this industry to be more than willing, if not eager, to deal with you in good faith on any issue before you, this included. It was in that spirit that I tried to be as candid as I could in characterizing how we got here today. That's how.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess what I have to say is that here you have two parties negotiate a compromise, and at least one of the two parties is under the assumption that that was a compromise, and so they didn't bring in their half of the dog and pony show. And so I find it a little striking that this is how things are done in the building now. I just want to register that.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran. I'm just delighted the House is actually letting us put our own fingerprints on a bill. So.
Yeah, there is that.
Thanks. Let's have Senator Metzger come on up. Sorry, I had to do
it. Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And thank you for the opportunity to comment. On the House bill before you today. Actually, I wasn't planning to testify, but based on some of the comments that Senator Corcoran was making in my office, I thought that would be appropriate to come down and talk about this bill. I am, of course, a former broadcaster. Actually worked for one of the stations of the gentleman who's just here, although was not there at the time and cannot give him either credit or liability for my employment during the time at KOIN-TV. But I want to give you a little context of why this bill is here, why it's important, and talking about the bill as you have before you, which was the negotiated bill, and in the House of Representatives, and why I think it is important. First of all, broadcasting is much different than almost any other profession I know. And when you talk about contracts, and I think, Senator Burdick, you brought up some points, I think, that pretty well articulated that issue. And that, you know, a contract is a contract. The question is, when the contract is over, you know, what right do you have to limit someone's livelihood when a contract is no longer in effect? The fact of the matter is, and I can't say all because I haven't checked recently, but if you look at the biggest money makers in the broadcast industry, for the most part, in terms of news, network television, most of those do not have non-compete contracts. And the reason is that they're compensated in the contract for any changes from their duties. And both management and labor in this negotiation can include and certainly does include when you have negotiating power, which, by the way, the young man who isn't here because we didn't think it was necessary from Bend, who was making $23,000 a year at a radio station in Bend and lost you know, his job and was unable to pursue his profession because he had a non-compete, even though they didn't want him to work. They didn't want him to work anywhere and didn't have that ability to do that. But if you are the heads of CBS News and you're Dan Rather or any of those folks and you have some negotiating power, you'll find that those people in their contracts have compensation, both vice versa. Major League Baseball does it all the time when those contracts are over. But they're compensated for that. They're compensated for that decision. So when the and to say, well, this is their own free will, as was mentioned a moment ago, to sign a contract that has a non-compete in, you know, that's kind of like asking the members of the National Guard in Iraq that, you know, you can go on this mission if you want, and it's your own free will. Well, you really, that's kind of limiting when your sergeant is telling you to do something. When you get into a situation of looking for a broadcast job, let's say it's in Portland or Spokane or Boise or anything else, there's a limited number of jobs. There's three or four stations that can employ you. And if you want to work, you have no really opportunity to negotiate that contract. You are not Dan Rather and don't have that ability to do that. What you do hope that you'll be treated fairly, that you will honor your contract. contract and have to pay if you leave and go to another station. They have invested in you, and it's certainly fair to have those types of qualifications in there and compensation, and vice versa. But when that contract is over, to say you cannot continue your form of employment. Why is broadcasting different? And I'm not sure if that was brought up here, since I didn't see the entire hearing. It came up in the House committee, and I want to make it very clear why this industry is different than being working for a hotel chain or working for a car dealership or anyone else. Is that these jobs are the public airways. You're talking about the public airways, which are limited by the Federal Communications Commission. And as a result of that limitation for the FCC, those jobs are limited by that limitation. And that's important. And finally, Madam Chair, it was pointed out about, you know, why do we have the discussion with the compromise and why isn't that a compromise now? I will say I think Mr. Fiscom was totally candid, was totally accurate in his portrayal here of what was happened in the House. He mentioned he wanted to go give you some background as why they got there. And so he has characterized this correctly, but as an ex-broadcaster, I did go through the tape and got the exact quote from when the bill passed the House on May 21, 2003, passed the committee from Mr. Fiscom. It says we can accept the Dash 5 amendments. Thank you on behalf of the Association and our appreciation for the positive spirit with which you have dealt with us. Thank you from the Association. Bottom line is we can accept the Dash 5 amendments, can settle for this bill. I believe we should settle for the same bill we settled for 6 weeks ago. And I think that's in dealing with good faith. I don't support the amendment because it's not part of the negotiated deal. But this was a settlement. We agreed to that. We think that was in fair negotiation. I think we should settle for the same. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. Questions?
I actually do have a question, and I'm just trying to get some analogies here. And I'm like trying to figure out why this is different than a law firm that spends 10 years training a lawyer, and the lawyer walks away. And for me, that's the value investment that the law firm chose to put into that lawyer. And you talked about why the broadcasting industry is different. But a contract is a contract. I mean,
right.
You know, a lot of people sign prenuptial agreements that I think are, you know, really stupid, but they sign them anyway. I mean, why is this not a free choice?
Right. And you've talked about it absolutely right, Senator Brown. It is a contract. But we're not talking about breaking a contract. We're talking about when the contract is over. And what are the compensations that should be mutual? You can write into a contract that you can sit out for a year. And if we require you to sit out a year, we're going to pay you $50,000 or whatever. That's what we give in exchange for not having you jump town to some competitor. And that's a fair trade for us because we've invested a lot of money in you, and therefore, when the contract ends, if you don't want to renew, then that's the trade-off. Well, what you're saying here is this is a unilateral decision, is that not only we're not going to compensate you for not working, we're not going to allow you to work. That's where it's different. I'd say in the law firm is the same way, Senator. If you have a major partner of a law firm, I'm sure in their agreements that they have different compensations that are negotiated upon departure of any partners and how that settlement should be affected, and because they're lawyers, I'm sure they negotiate a fair deal for both sides. What we're talking about is a unilateral agreement that does not affect the worker.
So it's not part of the contract itself.
Right. It can be part of the contract, but the problem is when you're making $23,000 a year in Bend, you have no negotiating right. You know, you're not Tom Brokaw, and you're not Dan Rather. And if you just want to work for us, you take our terms, and we decide we don't want you working anywhere else, that's how it's going to be.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Senator Metzger? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dave McDonald and Mike Cheney. We won't hold your last name against you.
Me with
Uncle
one.
Dick.
You certainly like your last name.
You would think that people would learn how to spell it now.
Well, I'm not sure that whoever wrote them down didn't know how to spell them, but that's okay. Fire away.
Okay. Go ahead, Mike. Madam Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Mike Cheney, and I am currently the general manager of four radio stations owned by Combined Communications in Bend. And I guess one of the things that bothered, and I'm going to be brief because I know you have other things to do, but and I have a copies of my testimony, but one of the things that really bothers me about the whole thing is the singling out of one industry. And much like you asked the question, Senator Brown, I disagree with Senator Metzger, and I do think that his example, particularly of the young man in Bend, the reason the young man from Bend is not here is he's on the air right now on KXIX in Bend. So apparently he is working. And so I guess I agree with Mr. Fiskum's analysis of looking at it on a case-by-case basis rather than trotting out one guy who becomes the poster child for an entire industry. In our case, I've spent my entire career in smaller markets. It's not Portland. It's not the rated market, so to speak. We're talking about Ontario, LeGrand, Baker City, and Bend. And, you know, regardless of the size of your market, the radio business is very competitive. And so you might ask, what's important to have a non-compete in the size market the size of Bend? And my answer would be that it's not just important for the employer, but in our case, it's also very important for the employees. And when Senator Metzger represents that should be negotiated. In our case, when we do personal services contract with particularly morning show talent on our three music radio stations, it is negotiated. We give them job security, you know, job description, a guarantee of salary growth for a period of the agreement, regardless of the success or the failure of the radio stations. And short of termination for just cause, they have a job with our company for that period. In exchange for those peace of mind concessions on our part, for them, they give our company the non-compete agreement that protects us from a variety of circumstances. And that even in smaller markets, morning show personalities are really the face and voice. And, you know, to many listeners, they are the radio station. And they're the most important people on our station because they are that connected with our constituency, who in our case is our listeners and our advertisers. But we promote them outside just as they do in Portland on billboards, on television, in print. They're up in numerous events, being master ceremonies, doing charity events, local concerts, whatever. And we compensate these employees better than anybody else in our building. And we strategize with them. And they really are included when looking at and responding to what we consider to be proprietary information about our market, our marketing, our finances, and our overall company's health. And it certainly seems to me that when the station and the employees get together and talk about compensation, benefits, vacation, a guaranteed length of employment, that it's also appropriate at that time to discuss and agree upon a reasonable non-compete agreement at the same time. And it really is quite possible that all of those things up front would not be offered without the second, which would be the non-compete, because we wouldn't want to get into that position. So just to summarize, I'd point out that when such a contractual agreement serves to benefit both the employee and the employer, then in my opinion, it's a good thing and not a bad thing. And since this has been my experience with non-compete agreements, I can see no reason for the Oregon legislature to meddle in what is mutually agreed upon contractual arrangement between employer and employee. And since that is the case, at least in my situation, I don't see the reason that the legislation is necessary. And if it is necessary, then it certainly should be necessary for many, many other businesses across the scope of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks. You must be Dave McDonald.
I am Dave McDonald. I'm Senior Vice President and Market Manager for Infinity Broadcasting, six radio stations in Portland. And I'm going to keep my comments short, too, just to out of respect to your time. The reasonable non-compete provisions are an important consideration when negotiating the talent contracts in the media industry, because we invest substantial resources to recruit, train, market, and remunerate our employees, particularly on-air talent, and that's really what we're talking about here. The time and money and effort expended in building name recognition and promoting both the on-air talent and the station constitutes a legitimate business interest, given the harm that can result if an employee goes to work for a direct competitor immediately following the term of his or her agreement. Oregon courts have long recognized that non-compete provisions should be sustained if the geographic and time restrictions are reasonable.
and if they protect the legitimate business interest of the employer and do not cause undue hardship or are contrary to the public interest. Oregon courts apply a rigorous test to evaluate the reasonableness of non-compete provisions, and we believe that HB 2390 would remove judicial oversight from the process and eliminate a system of review that for years has successfully balanced the interests of employees and employers. We believe this legislation seeks a solution to a problem that does not exist, that the proposed measure amounts to private legislation that only benefits one special interest group, that is, non-sales and non-management employees in the broadcast industry. If such non-compete provisions are inherently unreasonable, then our feeling is it's odd that the legislation is directed at only one business within the state. I would also add a finer point to Senator Metzger's comments with regard to whether we pay people for the non-compete period or not. And all these contracts are different, or many of them are different. In our case, when we lay it out, we usually dedicate some percentage of the total compensation to the non-compete, which is laid out in the agreement, or a balloon payment is made up front to say, okay, here is an amount of money that will that you understand is being dedicated to the proposition that there's a non-compete when the contract is up. And this is to protect our business essentially from raids from competitors in what is a highly, highly competitive business. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Comments or questions? Thanks for being here today. Thanks for coming all the way from Bend. Chris Roquero? And Steve Lanning, why don't you come on up as well? And I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name.
No, actually, you did very well. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Representative Haas and Senator Metzger for their sponsorship of this bill. And I would also like to extend our thanks to former Representative Mary Alice Ford, who has been a valued guide to us through this legislative process. I will say that Senator Metzger made many of the points I hope to make today, for which I'm very grateful, so forgive me if I stumble as I try to not repeat those points, but I do have some others I'd like to make. Madam Chairs and members of the committee, I testify before you today as one of Senator Ginny Burdick's constituents and as president of the Portland Local of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA. AFTRA is a national organization representing over 80,000 members, including television and radio broadcast employees of local stations in every state and every national broadcast network. And I would like to point out that no representative of AFTRA was invited to into the compromise discussions that brought you HB 2390A. The original intent of House Bill 2390 was not to condone the use of non-compete provisions in the broadcast industry for up to 1 year, which would be the result of the amended language appearing in Section 6 of HB 2390A-8. There is no current case law, statute, or regulation in Oregon that permits the use of non-compete clauses of up to 1 year in any industry. Retaining that amended language would create law expanding the ability of broadcast companies to impose lengthy non-compete restrictions on Oregon broadcast employees, regardless of their rate of pay, guaranteed term of employment, existence of other similar restrictions in their contract, or the reason for termination of their employment. I urge you to uphold the intent of the original House Bill 2390 by supporting the amendments proposed in House Bill 2390A8, with the exception that Section 6B, which provides for damages, attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements should an employer violate the statute, should be retained and included as the last subsection of HB 2390A. Even though the language contained in Section 6 calls for a limit on non-competes of 1 year, the effect of that phrase will be an allowance of 1 year non-competes. National research conducted by AFTRA National Legal Staff has shown that if statutory language restricts non-compete clauses to a particular period of time, such as 1 year, broadcast companies inevitably impose the full permissible term on all broadcast employees. If the Senate passes HB 2390A in its current form, our Oregon broadcast employees will end up worse off than they currently are. Legislation banning non-compete clauses in the broadcast industry has been adopted in California, Montana, Alabama, Arizona, Illinois, Maine, Massachusetts, the District of Columbia, and Colorado, and is pending in Ohio. And just let me add that in Illinois, the legislation was brought forward by Republican sponsors. It was passed, the governor vetoed it, and the legislature overturned the veto. Since many other states have already banned non-compete clauses entirely, passage of HB 2390A as is will go against the national tide on this issue and contradict existing law in other states, putting Oregon broadcast employees at a disadvantage vis-a-vis their peers in other markets. National research has shown that the arguments repeatedly presented by broadcast companies in opposition to restrictions on the use of non-compete clauses are baseless. For example, the claimed investment made by broadcast companies in promoting talent is, in fact, part of routine advertising expenses that are a customary cost of doing business in the broadcast industry. Broadcast companies recoup those promotional costs relatively quickly through corresponding increases in their advertising revenues, which are based on ratings. In addition, not all on-air broadcast employees are promoted, and off-air broadcast employees are never promoted. Further, broadcast companies would immediately terminate any promotional campaign that did not result in increased ratings and advertising revenue. The subject matter of this bill is not a labor issue. This is a free market issue. Its ramifications go far beyond the ability of union and non-union broadcast employees to make a living in Oregon. Non-compete clauses, particularly in the broadcast industry, due to its unique nature, are simply an unfair restraint of trade and place an artificial cap on the market value of services provided by Oregon broadcast employees. Broadcast employees held to non-competes find themselves with three very unsavory choices. One, to subject their families to insecurity and financial hardship, depending on what they can receive from the state unemployment fund, while they wait out the term of a non-compete clause. Two, to uproot their families and move to unfamiliar and distant locations in order to maintain continuity of employment. Or three, to give up their chosen profession altogether and to seek another career. There is no business interest so important that it should be allowed to override a broadcast employee's fundamental right to earn a living in his or her field. Furthermore, no business interest used to justify non-compete provisions is so unique that it cannot be served through other contract provisions that attain the same goal and that are routinely included in standard broadcast employee contracts. I urge you, for the sake of Oregon broadcast employees, to support a ban on non-compete clauses in the broadcast industry. Anything less is a subversion of the original purpose of this bill and is not an acceptable solution to the problem it is intended to address. I thank you very much for your time, and I will answer any questions you might have.
Steve.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Lamming, and I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We'd like to see the committee move forward with this bill, but not exactly in its current form. We weren't involved in the discussions, the compromise on the House side either. There's a couple of sections of the bill that we like, and we think that they're certainly reasonable. The section that deals with the non-competition agreement in the broadcast industry would be void if the employer fails to make a good faith offer to renew a contract. We think that's a good provision, definitely keep it. A non-competition agreement in any industry is void if the employee is laid off. That's a section of the bill that came from the Bureau of Labor and Industry, and we think that's certainly good. The piece that we have a problem with is the piece that restricts non-competition agreements to 1 year for employees' future work. We'd rather have the current statute, which doesn't specify a time limit. And the reason is because we're talking about employees at all different kinds of income level. And I'm glad that I stuck a copy of Jeff Scovel's testimony in the House side here because his name's come up a couple of times. And I want to point out his testimony, one-page testimony, on April 8th before the House Judiciary Committee. He's from Bend. He was making $26,000 a year. He worked for 24 months, and his contract wasn't renewed. And his non-competition agreement prohibited him from working within 125 miles of the station for 2 years. And this guy came from Bend back in April and told the House Judiciary Committee his story. And at the time, he was receiving unemployment insurance because he couldn't get out of his non-competition agreement. In that hearing, he met an attorney named Nick Fish, who helped him get out of his non-competition agreement just recently. And he was under it for almost a year until he got out of it, receiving unemployment insurance. And so it happens at all kinds of levels of employees. They're not necessarily TV anchors on the evening news. They're folks that are making in the $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000 range as well. We like the Dash 8 amendments, which just take out that one-year reference. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Questions or comments? Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate your
thank input. You.
Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2390? Thanks. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2390 and take a minute while we switch over staff as we move to Senate Bill 906 for public hearing. Oh, it is you again.
That's okay.
We'll go to work session on 906 today. I need to see the committee, the witness list, et cetera. So, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 906 makes a number of changes regarding the building industry. It consists of five House bills and amendments to those five House bills that died when the Senate Business and Labor Committee closed. Those bills pertain to requiring persons registered, licensed, or certified by the State Plumbing Board or the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs to wear identification indicating their licensure. It also pertains to prohibiting a non-licensed electrical entity from advertising they are qualified to make electrical installations. It also pertains to creating a new contractor license class, a developer contractor, for a property owner or developer that arranges for construction work. It involves creating new provisions regarding public contracting prompt pay provisions. And it also changes to existing building boards. It reduces the number on the Building Code Structures Board. It eliminates the Tri-County Building Industry Service Board and creates a residential structures board and a mechanical board. And my staff measure summary goes into a lot more detail, and I will just conclude by saying there are three amendments that have been distributed, and as it sits, this bill has a Ways and Means referral.
Thank you. Mr. Long?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes Division. I'd like to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 906. I think staff did an excellent job of providing an overview of the bill. This bill is about improve. From our perspective, we facilitated two bills, two of these bills on the House side, and this bill, from our perspective, is about improving and clarifying code adoption, interpretation, and enforcement of the state building code. During our facilitation of the legislative work groups on the House side, we worked with business, labor, local government representatives to bring consensus to the variety of issues. Many times building codes issues have a variety of opinions, and we were able to work out agreements. The bill that you have before you represents those agreements. The division is currently presently neutral on the bill. We've analyzed this bill and believe that the clarity and the efficiencies provided with the board's process, the enforcement process with the licensing, will make it easier and more efficient for us to carry out our responsibilities. Regarding the fiscal impact, we have provided a fiscal impact statement some time ago identifying no fiscal impact to the Building Codes Division for those three bills that impact us. I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee. We feel, again, that this streamlines our processes, and it's going to make it easier for us to adopt codes with the boards group and with the primarily the licensing provisions in 2447. Questions?
Questions? Comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Does he wish to comment on any of the proposed amendments?
Is that to me, Senator Beyer?
Yes, please.
Yes.
I haven't seen many of the proposed amendments. I'm aware of issues behind them, so I can tell you that when we facilitated the legislative work groups on the House side, what you have before you was a result of those work groups. I'm aware of issues regarding inspectors and a clarification on some of the licensing provisions, but I'm not aware of the third issue. So can you tell me which?
How about, Senator Beyer, if we have the folks, if the amendments come up at some point, and then we'll let the proponents respond.
That would be great, and if Mr. Long is available at some point in time, if to
you bet.
After he hears amendments, I guess.
Thanks. Mr. DiLorenzo, why don't you come on up? Sean Miller, do you want to come up as well? Jared, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Hoyt Street Properties. I'm handing you our official lengthy testimony. I'm going to summarize it because I know you are pressed for time today. I'm here to testify in support of sections 68 through 77 of the bill, and these are the sections of the bill that relate to licensed developers. These are the product of the A3 consensus amendments to House Bill 3159, a bill that passed the House of Representatives garnering 57 votes. The A3 amendments were not reviewed by the House, but were the further product of more negotiations between my clients, between other proponents of the bill, and the Construction Contractors Board, and they represent consensus amendments. The purpose of the amendments and these sections of the bill are twofold. First, for just some backdrop, any person who owns property, who constructs property for resale, must register as a licensed construction contractor. In the case of a condominium project, like Hoyt Street Properties, projects in the Pearl District, lenders require single asset entities. So if you have 8 condominium projects going, you need condominium number 1 LLC or condominium 2 LLC, and they have to be separate entities that own each and every separate project. Because of that, each and every separate entity must register as a construction contractor. My clients and the people who are in this business have no problem with putting up the financial guarantees that are required for construction contractors or the insurance. The problem, and where the rubber meets the road, is that each of the entities must then propose one person from the entity who must take 16 hours of classes in order to meet the licensing requirements for the Construction Contractors Board. So if you have 6 entities, you must supply 6 separate people who will each take 16 hours of classes. And this, of course, becomes quite burdensome. And so we have proposed in the bill that if you are an owner or a developer, and if you are going to use 100% licensed construction contractors to do the work, in other words, you do no work at all yourself, that you may have a separate classification of license. You will put up all of the insurance provisions, all of the bonding that any other construction contractor would put up, but you need not take the 16 hours of classes for each entity. That's the first part of the bill. The second part of the bill has to do with what are the consequences if you fail to register as a construction contractor. This is a great trap for the unwary. Many people who own properties, who build them for later resale fail to register as construction contractors. If you fail to register as a construction contractor currently, you are barred from waging suit against other parties, even if you are sued. The consequence of this is that if you are sued for construction defects, you do not have the ability to get to the person who truly was responsible. And so what this bill also does is permit a holder of this special license or any other person who registers by April of 2004, to go ahead and sue downstream in order to get to the person who was ultimately responsible. We feel this is in the consumer's best interest because quite often these single asset entities have nothing more than the asset available to pay claims. For all these reasons, we believe these sections are in the public interest and will eliminate a layer of bureaucracy that really is unnecessary. Again, these are based on the A3 amendments, which are all consensus amendments. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. Portion of the bill, we are here to support Senate Bill 906. The particular provisions in the bill deal with prompt payment, which are begin on page 30 of the bill, which is sections 54 to 60 of section 60. The original bill, House Bill 3174, came over to the Senate after deliberations in the House, where it received a unanimous vote on the House floor. We further negotiated some issues within the bill as it got over here, and those were the Dash 8 amendments. The bill before you, or these sections, consist of those consensus amendments that we worked out with several different parties. It is supported by the entire construction industry. I want to thank the chair for hearing the bill and thank Senator Atkinson for giving his priority bill, for giving us the opportunity to do this. But I do want to state that the construction industry was one of the hardest hit by this current recession. And, you know, with work hard to come by, the issues that I heard from our members and that these associations pushed this particular bill was the work that they were doing, the biggest challenge was actually getting paid. I want to talk about the chain of payment in a construction project. You have the owner, you have the general contractor, and then you have all your subcontractors and suppliers. And if because of this recession, people were holding on to their money, and rightfully, you know, trying to hold on to their money as long as they can, and I understand that. However, after you do the work, you deserve to get paid. And what ended up happening, and on that chain of payment, if one person is slow on their payment in that chain, it affects everybody down the line. And when it affects everybody down the line in businesses, it affects the workers that rely on that paycheck to come home every week or every other Friday. And so, in those reasons, we support payment provisions. The bill is very simple. It provides for a 30-day billing cycle. But it also, I want to state that it allows flexibility in creating that billing cycle. So under the bill, it creates a 30-day cycle. However, you can put a notice of alternative billing cycle out. So if an owner decides, I'm going to pay every 60 days or 45 days, they can do that. All they have to do is they stick a notice out on the plans and specifications. That's when contractors actually bid on the project. Then the contractor themselves can say, well, if it's an alternative and something different than statute, that yes, they can afford to do it, or no, I can't afford to work so many days and not get paid. And so it does allow the flexibility for them to make the choice on those projects. I want to state we did work with the engineers and architects, because when you do put it on the plans and specifications, that's something that they are responsible for. We made it on page 32 of the bill, lines 2, we made it that the owner is responsible for providing that on those plans and specs. So when they ship it out to, like, the plumbing contractor, the electrical contractor, all the suppliers, they're able to see if there's an alternative billing cycle other than the 30 days provided by statute. The two provisions in the bill that are the teeth of the bill is the interest on page 34, which is the rate of 1.5% a month. interest. It's not uncommon in business to provide that when people are late. And the second one is suspension of performance under the contract. So, and you would suspend performance only if you gave notice and then on the seventh day. So if someone gives notice that they, I haven't been paid on time under the provisions of the bill, the owner can easily rectify that within the 7 days before any. And my guess, we want to keep working that or rarely, but it is the hammer to negotiate with owners and subcontractors with generals and so forth. Page 36 of the bill, we exempted public contracting in 1999. We actually passed prompt payment provisions on public contracting. We tried to incorporate them as one process, but we're unable to do that with local government. So we, even though they are very close and similar, we there is a separate statute that deals with public contracting and for prompt payment of. And Madam Chair, Dan O'Brien, who is a member of ours, this is he's the principal drafter and person responsible for pushing this. He's also here today. If there's any questions, practical questions on the effects and what the industry has. What it really is out there, what it is like out there. And he is here if there's any questions, and we would support the passage of the bill. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I will be speaking specifically to Section 67 dealing with electrical contractors, but would like to make a couple statements regarding Senate Bill 906 as a whole. We do support Senate Bill 906, and as you've heard before, Senate Bill 906 is a product of five separate bills that all received over 55 votes. In favor from the House, and then were killed in the Senate. They were all consensus-based amendments that were brought in and incorporated to the bills, and we feel there's a lot of support for the Senate Bill 906 as it is right now, and we'd encourage its passage. Section 67 basically says that if you do not have an electrical contractor's license, that you cannot advertise and tell the public that you are licensed to do electrical contracting work. So basically tells people who don't have licenses that they can't tell the public or lie to the public that they can't do it. And that's what Section 67 states. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if you have any other questions on any other sections of the bill, I can answer those as well.
Any comments or questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I make one other comment? This has to do with the Ways and Means reference on the bill, and I left something out. We're all requesting that the Ways and Means reference be deleted. I've distributed a letter from Craig Smith of the CCB indicating that the sections of the bill that affect the CCB will have no measurable fiscal impact, and I believe there are other documents around indicating the same with respect to the other sections of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the committee members, pages 1 through 30, we have Bob Shiprack and Scott Berry available if there are any questions. And then on pages 36 to 37, we have Ron Murray available. Ron, do you want to come up and testify? You don't need to. Okay. So for committee members, those folks are available to answer questions now that Mr. Shiprack has turned off his cell phone.
Nice. That's beautiful.
That's all you're allowed in this committee.
Right. Janine Delani, Bob Pike, and Patrick Rogers, why don't you come on up?
He's coming around. Cheers.
For the record, my name is Janine Delani, and I'm the director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, and I will be brief because I've also brought Bob Pike, who is going to do some testimony, and Patrick Rogers. We are concerned about the provision in this bill that in making the structures board go from 15 to 9, they eliminate the position appointed by the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I somehow missed this when it was in the House, I guess, so I apologize for that. I had not known that that was happening. I did know they were creating two additional boards that we did not need representation on, but we believe that it's critical to have the perspective that we represent on the Structures Board. It's not advocacy. What we represent is expertise on building codes that have to do with providing access to people with disabilities. And if that is no longer on that committee, there are already issues that come before us. We have a program, a structural access designee program, where we have trained people in the building codes to be able to provide and interpret codes that have to do with disability access. And they provide that expertise to building code officials around the state. But we also serve on that committee so that as discussions happen for code changes and other issues, we're right there to talk about what those implications are for the structural access to people with disabilities. So having said that, I would like to turn it over to Bob Pike now to provide more technical information.
Thanks. Bob, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Pike. I've been a member of the State Accessibility Committee for the past 12 years. I've chaired the committee for 8 of those years. I'm an attorney, and my area of expertise is the ADA. The committee and the work that we do as designees is provide technical assistance to building officials and architects and builders on the accessibility provisions within the state building code. We provide advice, technical assistance, interpretation. We assist on waivers and appeals. Oregon has a long history of promoting access for people with disabilities. With the passage of the ADA, the Oregon legislature mandated that we adopt the ADA, but we also keep the more stringent provisions that we had in the state of Oregon building code. For example, under the ADA, a person could build a two-story building with 100,000 square feet per floor and not have an elevator. Under the ADA, you could build a 10-story building with floors with 3,000 square feet or less and not have an elevator. In the state of Oregon, we've kept more stringent provisions that mandate accessibility to those types of buildings. And that's not unique to Oregon. Many states, if not most states, have provisions that are more stringent than the ADA. Washington, California, North Carolina, Florida are just a few examples of that. Oregon has always had people with disabilities involved in this process to provide the expertise and the technical assistance. You know, to explain to someone why a toilet seat is required to be 17 to 19 inches above the floor is because a wheelchair has its seat at that level, and that assists in the transfer process. So we provide that kind of information and explanation about what the codes require. With the passage of the ADA, we now have federal civil rights legislation that we monitor and that we help Oregon ensure that they're adopting provisions that don't conflict with the ADA and adopt provisions that track the ADA whenever necessary. As Janine said, we're here specifically to talk about Section 19, which reduces the membership from 15 to 9. And if you'll look in that provision, in the very beginning, it says, the Building Code Structures Board shall assist the director of the
park. I'm going to stop you. I shall make sure for the record. My understanding is Section 17.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
I apologize.
That's okay. I just wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same page, so to speak.
It directs the Building Code Structures Board to assist in administrating the structural, prefabricated, and energy programs described in this chapter and the accessibility to persons with physical disabilities program described in the statute. So it recognizes that that's an important part of the Oregon Structural Specialty Code. And we urge you to review that particular provision, which eliminates a representative from the Disabilities Commission, and look to amend that. Thank you.
Thanks. Patrick, welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Patrick Rogers. I also am on the advisory committee for the structural. My case is really simple.
I have no problem.
After 53 years of being in this chair, I'm going to be very protective of this right that we have. Excuse me. And I also want to point out that, you know, we're not the little disabled that you were used to back 53 years ago. We're bringing I, the attorney, the other people on our boards are civil engineers, architects, and these are all disabled people. And they are bringing to it something that I don't think the average person who has not walked in my moccasins can really understand the need for someone that knows ADA like we do, because we live it, and also have the expertise in building codes, architecture, civil engineering, to bring to the state. And by the way, I must point out that these people are volunteering their billable hours to help the state of Oregon. So it's not that this is something we really want to guard very jealously. And I do would like that position to be kept. And I won't guarantee that it'll be kept by this level of people into perpetuity. But as long as I have anything to do with training some of these people, you're going to get quality people.
Thanks,
Thank
Patrick.
You.
Any comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to come before you.
Mark, or does someone want to come up from the proponents and talk about why this change was made to the committee? I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position, but...
Huh? Good afternoon again.
Okay.
Mark Long with Building Code. Can you come in?
Yeah.
Can you hold my phone?
Somebody call me.
Oh, no, quick.
One mistake.
I first need to apologize to the committee and to the folks that do have amendments. We've talked about these issues. I failed to pick them up at the desk, so I am familiar with these issues. Okay, and I'll be happy to talk about them. In regards to the previous testimony, House Bill 3460 is a result of I don't know how many sessions of discussion over how we manage our boards and our boards process. And Building Codes Division has several boards that help advise us on codes, interpretations, enforcement issues. We use advisory committees as part of those boards. This bill is about streamlining those processes, but not eliminating the advisory committee. We believe that adequate representation from all the different groups that aren't part of the board in its reduced manner can be provided on the advisory committees when you adopt codes. Specific to this issue, there is very good statutory direction for the Building Codes Division, regardless of what the board does, to provide adequate accessibility standards. And I would be happy to refer the committee to Chapter 447. It's one of the best pieces of statute I've seen as far as providing policy direction on a particular technical matter. So that's really the background for it. It was through the years and then this year's consensus process with the construction industry. There's a question of, since we're clarifying the various areas, the mechanical and residential and structural area, where can you reduce, where can you add back? And we've made commitments to other entities that aren't part of the new board that they will be on the advisory committees when those kinds of issues that impact them come up. And so that's kind of the backdrop that I have, and I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Yes. Madam Chair, Bob Shiprock, Oregon Building Trades. I'm just the deliverer of the portion of 906, which was House Bill 3460. We made conscious decisions, and Mark's earlier comments pretty well summed up what are in the first 30 pages of this bill, so I'm not going to repeat it. But it was an attempt on the industry's part. These statutes haven't been looked at in decades. And so what we had was this hodgepodge of codes and boards, and we sat down as an industry, not this session, last session, this is 3 years of work here, to try and make sense out of these boards so that they worked better for what they were intended to do. We had residential people involved in high tech, where they had no knowledge, and conversely, high-tech people worried about a water heater in a house somewhere. So we set up a residential board, and we said, okay, all this stuff for houses is going to go over there. and you're going to have expertise in that issue here. We're going to reform the Structures Board, and I'm going to answer the chair's question right now. And then we also said there's mechanical issues in the Structures Board. We're going to take that out, and we're going to set up a board of experienced people dealing with mechanical issues so they're not sitting there worrying about reinforcing concrete walls or something. The Structures Board, and I'm just going to be frank, I'm not on any of these boards, and I was kind of the neutral person to try and pull all this stuff together. This board currently is not functioning very well. The intent of the restructuring was twofold. There's currently 15 members. It's unworkable. There's too many people. And if you look at the current makeup, this is what struck me. There's not a person on here that builds anything. There's not anybody that builds, but it's a structures board. So we said, let's get some builders on there, people that have to deal with these codes every day, or people that have to train to these codes. Lower the number of individuals on there so it's more functional. And last but not least, and I want to address the chair's concern, we're very aware of the ADA as well as fire and life safety issues, because those are the two areas, committee, where there's the worst problems in uniform interpretation of the state code. So if this committee was or board was working well, we wouldn't have the problems we currently have. My response, and I happen to sit on a community development corporation doing low-income housing, so I have an interest in that, is to take a look at the 9 people we currently have and make very careful selections to the governor that an architect, perhaps, who is familiar with ADA, and we've got a lot of them in this state, that does commercial, industrial, ADA, fire and life safety, pick a general contractor who's knowledgeable about ADA and these other issues as well as these other codes. Somebody that's on this board that's going to show up at the meetings and knows what they're talking about with the advice of both low-income housing people and people with disabilities. That was what we envisioned. It was an attempt to make this work better. That's what it was about, and I'm just trying to be as frank as possible about this. And we left in a public member who might be that person too. We don't know. But I'm kind of glad the issue is raised. I talked to some folks yesterday. It's not to exclude. We need their help to make these codes better, and so they're more understood, and so Mark's folks have uniform interpretation of these codes. I'll just end by saying you can build a building in every different municipality in this state, and you're probably going to get a different interpretation on ADA, and that's really unfortunate. I'll answer any other questions.
Thanks. I think, Bob, one of my frustrations, I have a friend who's in a wheelchair. She has MS. And we were over at the Supreme Court building, and I could hardly get her in and out of the bathrooms over there. And I know that the Capitol itself is pretty inaccessible. And so I'm just really concerned that our public buildings, in part because of their age, but are just not that accessible.
That's true. That's why ADA was passed. It was a good law. But like I said, I'll stand with my statement. In building the affordable housing I've built, and we've built 4 projects all over the state, when you get into those areas of the code, you're at the whim, unfortunately, of the local building official, all who have different ideas of what it means. For everyone, I think it's in our best interest, and I've heard the same complaints from the architects. But it's a good law, and it needs to be enforced.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks, guys. Sandy Flicker, Bill Cross, and David Barenberg, did you wish to testify, or someone from...
Madam Chair, I can be very, very brief. Dave Barenberg, Legal Oregon Cities. We had the Dash 2 amendments, which we do not wish to put forward at this time and are continuing to work with the other parties. So with that, I'd like the Chair's... permission to retreat.
Thank you. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Rural Electric Co-op Association. Tom O'Connor represents the Oregon Municipal Electric Association, and we do have amendments to the bill. We have no position on the current Senate Bill 906. However, we have are requesting an amendment to the bill to take care of a definition problem that we discovered about 2 weeks ago after a discussion with the some of the staff from the Building Codes Division. And it came to our attention that there was an omission in the definition of utility, and we felt pretty strongly that we needed to try to take care of that. The statute that we are looking to amend is ORS 479-540. Our amendment makes no substantive change to current provisions of the electrical code in ORS 479-540. All electrical utilities in the state, investor-owned utilities like PG, Pacific Core, and Idaho Power, and consumer-owned utilities, being the co-ops, the PUDs, People's Utility Districts, and the municipal electric utilities, are all regulated by the PUC. They're under the National Electric Safety Code. That is across the state. Therefore, the state electrical code, the NEC, or National Electric Code, has an exemption for electric utilities in it because of the regulation by the PUC. However, the definition in that exemption statute talks about public utilities. And public utilities in most of the statutes mean investor-owned utilities. In 757, which is the electrical utility statute, it clearly defines investor-owned utilities as public utilities, and then it has a definition for cooperatives, a definition for PUDs, and a definition for municipal electric utilities. And many of the statutes, after doing a statutory search, many of the statutes do, when they say public utility, they say it's public utility, electric co-op, People's Utility District, and Municipal Electric Utility, because that is the comprehensive definition in the state of utilities. Unfortunately, we don't have just one definition. We have it broken down into different types of utilities. But currently, as I said, 479-540 only says public utilities. It does not differentiate. It does not include cooperatives, PUDs, or municipal electric utilities as we read that now. So it needs to be a comprehensive definition. In meeting with the electrical inspector, they are interpreting that statute, that exemption statute, as if it applies to all utilities in the state. So all we have here is an omission in statute in terms of the definition of all the utilities in the state. As I said, it clearly makes no substantive change. Current practices, all utilities are treated the same, both under the NEC and the NESC. And so therefore, we have obviously, because of the lateness of coming into the session with this, we're looking for a vehicle to use to take care of this problem. If it's not taken care of, it's not necessarily going to cause an immediate problem, but there are some reasons why it should be taken care of in statute. And so I guess what we're asking is, if the committee is going to entertain amendments to this bill, that we would very much appreciate your support of these amendments. Thank you.
Somebody wish to add anything? Okay. Bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. I believe you have a copy of the -1 amendments. They address an issue that actually occurred in the development of a low-rise residential code, a definition that is new to the bill. This was part of one of the five bills, and generally OBOA is in support of this bill. There are many good aspects to not only this bill, but a couple of the others that we worked on with the other stakeholders. However, between being approved in the House and coming over to the Senate, there was the inclusion of a new residential code, low-rise, which would allow row houses and apartments, three stories and less, to be included in the residential code. And we favor that as well because it allows for some more affordable multifamily housing opportunities. Our issue was simply to allow current residential of one and two family inspectors to also inspect those row houses because the structural, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing installations are identical to with what you'd find in a one and two family dwelling. It would offer us an opportunity to provide better customer service to our home builders, as well as to some of our commercial customers who we could then allow our A-level, those inspectors that have the higher levels of experience to focus on their projects. We are aware and have detected an interest from the sponsors of the bill to keep the bill clean and avoid any amendments. However, we wanted to provide this legislative body with this opportunity to look at some additional regulatory streamlining. You've done quite a bit this session, including the Senate Bill 711 through 715 series, and we just wanted to add this to the mix.
Thank you. Sorry, consent.
Thank you. Sandy, I didn't hear you mention Senate Bill 710. It's my understanding that if your amendment didn't get into this bill, you've worked with the proponents of this to put 710, which is now in Ways and Means, which will be assigned to Transportation and Economic Development, put your amendment in there. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, that is another vehicle. Clearly that's another vehicle because it actually amends this particular statute that we're looking at. Of course, we have a concern with the bill in Ways and Means that has fiscal impact and not being the sponsors of the bill. We can't make a determination clearly about whether that bill is going to make it through the process or not, but it certainly is a vehicle. We're trying to work with the group that are supporting this legislation to make sure that all of the proponents get their needs met, and we would like to get our needs met as well. So,
well, we're going to sign you die tomorrow, so I'm not sure either.
Well, maybe it wasn't that important.
I didn't know you were in charge of that. I'm so glad. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Mark Long will have to answer this question, but under where the Dash 1 amendment that Bill Cross has spoken to is intended to go into Section 33 of the bill, it says that the DCBS shall adopt rules, the way I read that, on the inspection of buildings and how it works. And I'm just curious to know whether or not you actually need to be in the statute or if rules could be adopted to accommodate this issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, earlier today, in fact, there was a discussion about possibly addressing this through administrative rule. We would be happy to pursue that avenue because I think you have pointed out some language there that would enable the division. Mr. Long could obviously comment, and if, in fact, there is that administrative flexibility or opportunity, we would be happy to pull this amendment request and work with the division and the other stakeholders on an administrative approach.
Would Mr. Long be available to come up and answer that question?
I'm sure he would love to come up and respond to you, Senator Beyer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Mark Long for the record, Administrator of Building Codes. To the question of the Dash 1 amendments, we have talked earlier this afternoon about an administrative solution. It's usually our practice to get all the stakeholders together to try to come to consensus agreement. That's what you have with Senate Bill 906. For the most part, we were unable to reach that consensus agreement very quickly out in the hall, but I am willing to entertain an administrative solution if the amendment is pulled, and get the parties together and see where that goes.
So just to be clear, you would have the authority to do that. Whether or not you can get it done is a different issue, but you do clearly have the authority to do that.
Yeah, we've looked at it, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer. We've looked at the issue and believe that there is the administrative authority to add the provision of the row house inspector under our certification standards. The question is whether you get all the parties through the public process to agree.
You have about 24 hours.
Got it.
Actually, I suspect the Capitol building will be fairly quiet at 3:15 tomorrow. We'll make that about Monday this time. See if you guys can work something out.
Great.
Okay. Anything else? I want to close the public hearing. I want to check out a couple things, but I anticipate this bill will move very quickly, and given the fact that we are under 1 hour notice, it may move in relative short order. So, thank you, everybody.